It's a really good certificate to have on your resume. In the studio, we have Ben Shannon from the Trey Arrow National Speaking Tour. Ben, welcome to the studio.
Thanks, brother.
We're so glad that you're here. As soon as I saw the poster, I'm like, I know that elfin fellow. He's definitely known in these parts and known in our hearts, that's for sure, for the work that he's done in the States and stuff. But let's talk a bit about what the tour is about. Like, where are you coming from?
We're coming from all the way on the other side of the country. We started in Halifax, the Media as a Judge speaking tour. And we've been traveling across the country now since January, speaking about the media and the media's role in the case of Trey Arrow, and more importantly, the corporate media, the large multinational print media, the large multinational television media and radio media too. The more larger multinational companies have been quite a damaging role in giving Trey the ability to have a fair trial in Portland, and have been doing a very good job at creating a term and a label against Trey's name. The label, of course, is an eco-terrorist, and that label has a huge history behind it when it comes to environmentalism, and even it's where it was originally created. The company, the individual, the PR group which created the term eco-terrorist, and their ties not to environmental organizations, not to groups that care about the environment, but more importantly, groups that destroy the environment, like big multinational logging companies who fund these organizations. You can start to extrapolate a fairly clear understanding of where and the reasons for these organizations to be labeling peaceful environmentalists like Trey an eco-terrorist.
Eco-terrorism. Now, this is part of the American government's work to label anybody as a dissident, any social activist, anybody involved with civil disobedience as an as a terrorist, but this one's specifically aimed at environmental terrorists. The term, to me, just is kind of ridiculous. Has Trey Arrow killed anybody?
No.
Has he flown any planes into buildings?
No.
Does he have brown skin?
No.
See, what the heck? Usually that's what we reserve for terrorists, people who are doing extremely crazy things.
It seems kind of ironic when you label environmentalists eco-terrorists. It seems kind of funny to think and sit back and see the corporate media and the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI, label individuals like Trey a terrorist, an eco-terrorist. I mean, there are a lot of key issues around the case. The fact that Trey has not even spent one second and put one foot into any courtroom to face these charges. But somehow he's been totally convicted in the eyes of the media, in the eyes of the public as well, throughout the Portland area, throughout the BC area. So he hasn't. The way the term is being used, you should be able to open up some different brainwaves to figure out why. Really, why they're calling Trey and other activists, other environmentalists, eco-terrorists.
So he's deemed an eco-terrorist. How did he get started on his path to eco-terrorism? Like, where did Trey first, like, what were his first actions or his first environmental civil disobedience? Where did that start?
Well, it's important to go and as Professor Ward Churchill always states in his lectures, to know where you're going, you need to know where you've been.
Mm-hmm.
And Trey's case is very important, because if you actually understand his history as an activist, the well-documented peaceful, nonviolent actions he's participated in, when you draw all those links together and add in what the FBI is accusing him of, it doesn't come out with a balanced answer. The shoe doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
Trey was is an American. It's essential to understand. He's born in Florida, grew up, throughout the 80s and 90s, in high school, normal, quote unquote, everyday boy, captain of his wrestling football team, et cetera, et cetera. Went to Florida State University, became a vegetarian, started learning more about animal rights and environmentalism. And in the late 1990s, he traveled over to Portland, Oregon. And of course, if people are familiar with the environmental movement in California and Oregon and Portland, right away that it's really huge out there to save, the last remaining redwoods, the last remaining ancient forests.
Cascadia.
All the great actions out there. Trey got immediately hooked up with the Cascadia Forest Alliance, which is a peaceful, nonviolent direct action organization, which participates in a variety of tactics, all are very peaceful, including things like base camps and blocking logging roads by sitting in front of a logging truck, by occupying 600-700-year-old redwood trees or ancient forest, what they refer to as tree sits, platforms. That type of thing. Trey was very active with the CFA, the Cascadia Forest Alliance, during the late 90s, but more importantly in the summer of 2000 and 2000, or the years of 2000 and 2001. And the Federal Bureau of Investigations really truly started becoming aware, from what we understand, of Trey's actions. And when Trey feels like he started becoming under the close eye of the Bureau was in the summer of 2000. And on July 7th of 2000, at a base camp for a very old and ancient forest in Oregon, which is called Eagle Creek. Mm-hmm. And the CFA was doing a lot of work to try to save Eagle Creek. It was providing drinking water to a little over 200,000 Oregonians at the time. And Trey was working with the CFA, and on July 7th, the federal marshals and the Oregon Department of Forestry came in and raided a base camp and arrested a little over half a dozen peaceful activists that day, trying to break the back, if you will, of the base camps, which was providing support for the tree sitters and the platform sitters, etc. Later that day in Portland, a few hundred people rallied outside the U.S. Forestry Building to draw awareness, media awareness, to these raids and to the arrests. And the arrests were a very violent arrest, a paramilitary arrest. I mean, the so-called mustached blue men, the men in blue suits didn't come out. The police officers were known to trust, and when you're lost as a kid to go up and see, the police officers came out, were dressed quite literally in army fatigues.
SWAT team style
police officers came out and very brutally arrested, as I said, a little over a dozen activists. So the rally in downtown Portland was to draw awareness of this. At the very end of the rally, Trey, feeling a little bit discouraged about the lack of media attention towards an event that should have a lot of media attention, decided to climb up three stories on the side of the U.S. Forestry Building without ropes, without harnesses or belts, and perched himself on a small little 9-inch ledge outside the main office of the main forester at the time, and was immediately handed up a blowhorn and proclaimed he wasn't refusing to move until the U.S. Forest Service canceled the cut in Eagle Creek. And for the next, for the next 11 days, Trey sat
he
on that ledge.
He stayed up there on a 9-inch ledge for
11 days.
11 days.
Huge,
oh,
11
man.
Days. He was eventually given up a rope and a harness and strapped in properly, safely, so he could sleep and stuff. But 11 full days, he never touched ground, sitting on a side, three stories up on a 9-inch ledge. This brought international. We have clippings from all over Europe and Germany and other countries that were like, local Portland man sits on 9-inch ledge. It brought huge amounts of media attention and basically shot Trey up in the so-called spotlight of the environmental movement. If you were in Portland in the summer of 2000, you know who Trey Arrow is.
Yeah.
So that was really, as I mentioned earlier, when the Bureau started first focusing their attention on his ability to organize and draw massive amounts of support.
Public attention, worst enemy.
Exactly. And one of the great things about what came out of that was his example, his examples of always keeping everything peaceful. And on the morning of the 11th day, the police, under extreme pressure from the mayor and from the city council and from the Forest Service, of course, who had this person on the side of their building, finally made the decision to give Trey the warning that if you don't come down, we're going to have to come up and come get you down. And Trey asked for a few hours to delegate with his support crew and decided that there's no reason to have the police come up and, most likely violently remove him.
Yeah.
That he was going to come down peacefully to continue the actions peacefully and to set an example that actions don't have to be, necessarily violent. That he didn't want this action, which had attention all around the world, to be ending with the videotape evidence, footage of the police grabbing him and dragging him off down three stories and viciously arresting him.
I like that idea because sometimes it's like people, activists, assume that the end always has to be confrontation, but the actual beauty when you let yourself be taken after you've made your point is that you're in control.
Exactly.
You don't let them control you. You say, okay, I'm done.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, I admire him for that, for sure.
He came down, and the police actually didn't arrest him right away. I mean, they arrested him on the site, but he came down the 11th day, held a press conference, tugged and greeted all of his friends he hadn't touched in 11 days, and it was a beautiful action.
Peaceful.
Very peaceful. It was very well done, and so well done, so positive in the environmental community that a few months later, in the fall of 2000, Trey ran for Congress in an attempt to bring in the Battle for Eagle Creek to the floor of the Congress, the 3rd District, and try to really sort of affect change on the inside, and showing examples of different tactics, ledge sit, 11 days running for Congress. He gained 15,000 votes. I mean, this is how big he's already getting, 15,000 votes. And I'm not trying to prop him up, but what I'm more importantly trying to do is show people or tell people what kind of individual this person was.
Mm-hmm.
He was getting a lot of attention in the media and a lot of attention in the eyes of the Bureau, the Federal Bureau of Investigations, and more importantly, the logging companies, because he was making a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And for the next, year or so, Trey worked very hard with the CFA, the Cascadia Forest Alliance, was organizing, the support for the base camps that were still out in Eagle Creek, like the same base camp that was raided in July 7th. Like, there were more base camps set up, more trees had set up, and in the summer, or the, sorry, the fall of 2001, Trey was helping out with the second attempt to save some ancient forest, and the forest was a strip of forest in what was termed as God's Valley, and that is a G-O-D's Valley. And what's really ironic about God's Valley, it was sold to a company. It was sold by the ODF, the Oregon Department of Forestry, and it was sold to a company which ironically was named Christian Futures. And Christian Futures was logging God's Valley.
Oh my God.
And Trey was participating as well with the CFA. CFA was doing many, trying to save many different types of forests, including Eagle Creek and God's Valley. And Trey was out at a base camp one afternoon, and the police decided it was time to rally up to arrest all the tree sitters. And Trey was in a tree at the time, knowing that Trey Arrow, the Congress runner, the 11-day ledge sit was up in a tree, focused a lot of their attention on Trey, sent up a logger quite quickly to try to convince Trey to come down. And when Trey wasn't budged by the logger's request, the logger's, about 90 feet in the air in this tree sit, in this really old ancient tree, was given the order to cut all the branches below Trey. And Trey, was obviously worried about that. The logger cut all the branches below Trey, but before doing that, Trey was, under quite a lot of pressure and a lot of stress that the logger might actually cut the branch that he was on. He wasn't...
Did the logger actually cut where the platform was?
He wasn't actually in a platform. He was more in, let's say, a set of ropes. He was roped in. And he didn't actually have enough rope to reach the ground. The tree he was in had enough branches that all you would need is basically a rope to tie in, and you could just free climb up the tree, which he was quite good at, which I've seen him actually do during my friendship with him on the East Coast. But
so the logger was cutting the rungs of the ladder down to the ground.
And he did. He quite literally did. And Trey jumped actually to the... he was 98 feet in the air and jumped to the biggest redwood tree, or sorry, the biggest ancient tree he could find to try to save that tree.
That's called the flying squirrel.
The flying squirrel
tactic.
Move. Which 98 feet in the, over above the ground is quite dangerous. The logger came down from the tree that Trey was originally in, and a few hours later was given the instructions to climb up the tree that Trey had moved to. When he was up there, he was given the instructions from the logging company below, Christian Futures, to remove all the branches below, and basically came all the way down, cutting all the branches below him, quite literally stranding Trey in the tree. What is also interesting is the buffer zone. The buffer zone is an area where logging, which is, you know, it's a federal law that you're not allowed to cut a tree around someone in a tree.
Yeah.
All the trees around Trey were cut. Breaking the buffer zone, no investigation was ever looked into by the federal authorities why, you know, the logging company would, you know, risk this man's life, let alone
endangering his, possibly killing him.
By the trees falling on the tree that he was in, which is hence why the buffer zone is there. I mean, you could also look into the fact that why was the logging company cutting the branches below Trey, quite literally stranding him there.
Forcing him to remain in the tree, really.
Forcing him for the next 48 hours. But what's also interesting is that this situation keeps getting more and more interesting.
Oh, no.
Is it's well documented that the forestry, the logging company's tactics, Christian Futures, was they shone huge bright lights on Trey for the next 48 hours, blared him with bullhorns, repeatedly, from what Trey says, is backed up a small vehicle and shook the tree. You know, 98 feet in the air, when a Trey gets bumped by a vehicle like that, like, you know, a little bumper action.
To shake him out of the branches.
To shake him out, or just let him know that he's pretty high up, and to make him, his heart pound a little bit.
They weren't blaring like 80s music or anything.
I'm really not sure the kind of music, but I don't think blaring music is still bad in general. Nope. 48 hours with no sleep and you get pretty sleep deprived. October 2nd, around 2 in the morning, as I mentioned, Trey really didn't have enough rope to properly secure himself, fell 98 feet to the ground, and quite literally was about an inch from death. What ironically saved his life was the pile of branches that were cut from the tree that were piled up on the bottom below his tree. Is actually what, you know, if you will, padded the impact to the ground 98 feet. A good friend of Trey's, Beth O'Brien, had died about 6 months. 6 months later, in Eagle Creek, actually, she fell from 140, and she unfortunately didn't make it. So many people who fall from that height don't make the don't live past the 98 foot drop. Trey luckily did spend months in the hospital, but what that did is it just kept adding more and more fuel to the fire, if you will, of the FBI, letting them know that even falling from 98 feet, the poster boy Trey Arrow is still going to get up. Wake up and get in that wheelchair, and held a press release, his first available time, and a press conference, and was trying to let the world know that, you know, what these loggers are doing, what the government is doing, and what the FBI are letting, you know, the state officials are doing to the environmental movement, which is not a terrorist movement, which is a movement which is purely trying to save some of the only ancient forests left in the West Coast, or if you will, in the world.
Yeah.
So these are some really important events that should you could probably extrapolate an understanding that, like, Trey was definitely very popular, if you will, in the environmental movement. I don't think I need to mention the last name of an elder named Betty, who most people know who Betty is in BC, and to be honest, most people in Canada know, in the environmental movement, know who this lady Betty is. Well, you mentioned the name Trey in Oregon, you know exactly who Trey was, and you know the stories of Trey.
Yeah.
And that's what really helped the FBI set him up and target him to these alleged crimes.
So we're going to go cut to a tune, then we'll come back and we'll find out more about how the FBI is trying to extradite him. We'll find out more about how he ended up in Canada. This is Alex Gray with Lamentations.
From under a spell of terror, spilled illness and rage uncontained. Furious as hell, spurious oil well, rot in the heart, a sickly smell leaks through lies and tells the truth. That rings the bell that tolls for the U.S. Us. America, you sold your soul for a little capital. Fiends of death speaking with apocalypse and missile throats and iron lungs and crooked tongues. Corporation nation, killing truth, replacing goodness with greed, sacrificing beauty as minds and planet are polluted. Why must we so unfulfill our promise? How dare we stand for absence of freedom? Freedom is a real possibility, but America, we have sold our soul for a little capital. Without reliance on the Council of Liberation, we cannot rebirth a nation. We are a plague and a lamentation, malignant scourge of viral hucksterism, poisons little birds and little fish, big ones, two upon your plate, a consumption-like disease spreads like wild moles across your Gaian skin, turning soil into asphalt and concretized misconceptions of nature and humanity. America, do you want to be rich? Look through the lens of mystic truth and see your wealth, your infinite wealth. A holy, healing people, empowered with a vision for humanity. Democracy is possible. We can work together when we respect each other and serve and inspire and appreciate and forgive and consider each other as precious as our mother. Grieve now for all the nations of mothers and others we have slain. We are a stain and have sold our soul for a little capital. Restoration of our nation is not an idler's dream, but the fulfillment of a contract with God. Let us be one with all nations under God, indivisible. For God cannot be contained or limited or stained. God is indivisibly one with all of nature and life. Let us come into the center of reality, where the light of spirit shines in every heart, even under megatons of malice and our own weapons of self-destruction and mass distraction. Redeem your soul as soon as possible by leading the world in generosity and responsibility for the great web of flesh and spirit. Wake to your mistake. Resurrect your soul, my soil. Defend our family planet for the collective good. Respect the youth. Speak the truth. Face your demon, America. Transcend corporation nation and be one with creation. Wake from your nightmare and become the dream of world spirit.
Welcome back. You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio, 93.5 FM, CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicooperadio.com. And if you're down in the beautiful Queens Bay area, Kootenai Lake, down the Crawford Bay Zone, or even in Argenta, you're listening at 96.5 FM Kootenai Lake. In the studio tonight, we have Ben Shannon from the Trey Arrow National Speaking Tour. He will be speaking tomorrow night at the David Thompson Cultural Center, or Charlotte's, if you know that better, at 7 p.m. tomorrow, Monday. You got to be there. So if you believe in the environment and you believe in Canada as being a haven for people who are being persecuted in the States, this is one talk you have to hear, be at, and support. Also, the manipulation by mass media. The name of the tour is Media as Judge, which speaks to the whole media manipulation, especially in the United States, which Canada as a sovereign nation wants no part of. So 7 p.m. tomorrow. So Ben, Trey, he began with the Cascadia, then going into, what was the creek again?
Eagle Creek,
tumbled out of the skies from the logging companies. The FBI sets their fangs on him. Now what happens?
In the before the fall of 2001, in the fall of 2001, there was some actions happening in the Oregon area. I mean, what's really important to recognize with the environmental movement is that there's a vast variety of different tactics taken by the environmental movement. There are some activists, some environmentalists that take petition and letter writing campaigns, and they work on the government side, which Trey did. Mm-hmm. When he ran for Congress in 2000 and got 15,000 votes, and he did those types of actions. There are middle, there's actions in the middle where the people, block logging roads and sit in trees, which Trey did. Mm-hmm. And again, like Trey did, sat on the side of a building for 11 days to bring attention to the cutting of Eagle Creek. And there are other organizations and other groups and other people who take another type of tactic, and that would be to destroy a logging vehicle or to put out of commission logging equipment by like monkey wrenching them, or to flattening tires of logging vehicles, or in the case of another man named Jacob Sherman, Sherman decided on two separate occasions to burn some logging vehicles, a total of five vehicles, three logging trucks that actually carry the logs away, yeah, and two cement trucks on two separate occasions. What's interesting about Sherman's case is Sherman wasn't a very hardcore environmentalist. He wasn't an individual out in the front lines all the time. He was a basic environmentalist, wasn't exceptionally well known like Trey, wasn't the perfect target, if you will, by the FBI. What they were able to do, though, is arrest Sherman quite quickly after the second arson. He didn't get away with the crimes very quickly. After arrest, Sherman went through 4 days of FBI interrogation. Four separate days of interrogation.
Oh my God.
Where basically he was able to, he basically gave himself up after 4 days. He admitted to the arsons. What Sherman is doing is sitting in these FBI interrogation room for 4 days. He's also very aware of a man named Jeffrey Free Lewis. Lewis received 22 and a half years for burning three SUVs in the same state, Oregon. 22 and a half years for burning three sport utility vehicles. Sherman's sitting in an FBI interrogation cell.
He's looking at what he's facing.
He knows about Lewis. He knows about what he's facing. He knows what will happen to him, a 21-year-old Portland University student with a six-month pregnant partner who's about to give birth in 3 months. He knows his life is, quite literally going to be over when he's 50, when he gets out of prison. After 4 days of FBI interrogation, the FBI are convinced him to take a plea bargain, which would see him basically testify that Trey Arrow, who he knew, would is the mastermind of the charge, these crimes, these alleged terrorist attacks, these arsons.
That Trey was some kind of accomplice or the mastermind.
He was the guy
who forced him to do it.
Yes, he groomed him, as they would say. Oh. Convinced him to take on these actions and to burn these logging vehicles. Something that Trey quite literally denies at all stages of this case. Sherman, under 4 days of FBI interrogation, gives up Trey. Trey is, with this testimony, is enough evidence for the FBI to put out a warrant. Trey, not in the state at the time, hears about this, weighs his factors, knows that the FBI has been following him, been monitoring his phone calls, his emails, his activities, knows about the history of the FBI. Let's take a look at Judy Berry, Dale Turney. Let's take a look at Leonard Peltier. Let's take a look at all huge members. Obviously, you could say almost every member of the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army. You could take a look at almost any leftist organization, the Communist Party, the Anarchists, the IWW. I mean, they don't really have a very good track record for the left, if you will. Trey, fearing this, knowing about this, knowing the fact that Sherman is willing to testify, to save his own butt in a court that he was out there on those evenings and he burnt those logging vehicles.
He's being set up.
He fears this. He decides, my only hope is to hope to go to Canada and seek political refugee asylum. He comes to Canada and spend the next 2 years, or the next sort of year, basically going across Canada, where actually I met Trey, and trying to basically figure out how he was going to get into the refugee program, the political refugee program here, to seek asylum so he wouldn't be facing the FBI's onslaught.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really where we come up to reasons why Trey is in Canada. Like I said earlier, like the only evidence isn't videotape evidence. There's no videotape of Trey burning the vehicles. There's no fingerprint evidence. There's no Trey wasn't caught with a job, a few buckets of gas or devices to burn logging vehicles. Or there's no hard evidence at all.
All there is the word of this rat.
The word of this convicted arsonist, Jacob Sherman, who's saying that, after 4 days of FBI interrogation, I'm willing to say that it actually was Trey who burned the vehicle, and what about that plea bargain you offered me? Jacob Sherman, up against, Jeffrey Free Lewis, who was sentenced to 22 and a half, received an unheard of 3.5 years in prison, 41 months.
What?
Unheard of. He pled guilty, is willing to testify now in court, and received an extremely light sentence. And you compare that to Jeffrey Freelewers, who received 22 and a half years, you can start to understand why, or more importantly, how he got off on such a small sentence.
Well, Jeffrey Lewis too, he had the same deal. A person who was charged with the crime but agreed to testify against Lewis, and was able to plea bargain his way out. He got the similar type of sentence, I believe, wasn't it?
I think it's important to recognize what the FBI is doing there, right? They're doing is they're trying to... there's a larger issue, and we'll talk a little bit more about why they're labeling Trey as an eco-terrorist, but what they're doing is implementing the most effective tactic from the Roman Empire to the current state.
Yeah.
And that's a tactic of divide and conquer. To take a movement, cut it in half, blame each other for each other's actions, and sit back and watch them fighting amongst each other. Yeah. They're turning environmentalists against each other.
Yeah.
To discredit the movement, but more importantly, to discourage environmentalists from participating in actions and peaceful actions to defend, not some capitalist state, a Walmart, a bank. They're not defending these. They're defending what we need to live. And that isn't capitalism, that isn't the banks, that isn't the Walmart, that's the trees that provide us air, that's the environment, that's the earth that we live on. And these people are called eco-terrorists, so it's really important to recognize what the FBI is trying to do.
Well, it's ironic, too, that three SUVs, you kill three SUVs, you get 22 years, you kill a person, you kill three people, you get 21 years.
Well, what's...
You know what I mean? You kill a vehicle, you get 22 years. You kill a person, you get 7 years.
Yeah. What's interesting is go to Jeffrey Free Lewis is the man's name. You go check out his website, do a Google search, you get his website. The Lewis Defense Committee has actually put up a link on their website listing all the individuals in Portland who've committed a crime and been sentenced. Some of those individuals were actually sentenced by the same prosecutor or by the same judge. You have individuals in there being sentenced for 7 years for molestation. You have individuals being sentenced for 12 years for second degree murder. Same judge, second-degree murder, 12 years. Same judge, three SUVs, 22 and a half years. You can see the connection with Luer's case. You can see the politically motivated sentencing system within Portland, within Oregon, but more importantly, within the United States.
I saw a banner ad one time on the Drudge Report, you know, that right-wing website, and it was said, if you're an SUV owner, you could be a victim of domestic terrorism. So support the domestic terrorism bill. You know, like, they have a bill now for SUVs, like, property. Protect our SUVs.
Well, what the sentence says to Jeffrey Luers is that the property, the SUVs, is more important than the child molested by the same, by the dude, like, a year earlier was sentenced to a few years, or the murder.
Yeah.
What's really important to recognize a few different things around the word terrorism and around the media is that the term terrorist has actually been so branded, so included, so manipulated into Trey's name that the word eco-terrorist Trey Arrow has become a name in itself. It has become so synonymous with Trey and his case. But the fact is the FBI, and the fact is that the state prosecution is not charging Trey with terrorism. There's no evidence, there's no charges, there's nothing to do with terrorism in Trey's case except the use of the media and the PR groups and the FBI's use of the word to scare the society from this eco-terrorist. I mean, he was the number one domestic terrorist in the United States while he was in Canada. The number one domestic terrorist is a dude, a shoeless, long-haired, raw foodist, vegan hippie who lives and hugs trees. He's the number one domestic terrorist, and we're fighting people who are flying planes into buildings and trying to, you know,
have guns,
and we're
kill people.
Yeah, we're scared of a long-haired, you know, raw foodist who won't even burn, you know, he won't even burn like trees, like he won't even burn dead branches to stay warm in the woods if he had to because of the pollution it would provide in the environment. And this is the number one eco-terrorist. Judge Redding, the individual who sentenced Jacob Sherman, the man Trey's co-accused, the man who is took the plea bargain, the 4 days of FBI interrogation, took a plea bargain. Judge Redding, in his ruling against Sherman, verbally, in the middle of the prosecution's lingo back to the judge, the prosecution's going off about Jacob Sherman and getting ready for the judge to sentence Sherman. The judge stops him and says, listen, quote, the term terrorist is not to be used in reference to this case or the defendants, end quote. That's Judge Redding going off about saying, listen, because the prosecution was constantly referring to Trey Arrow and Jacob Sherman as terrorists, eco-terrorists. And the judge, in a court in Oregon, says you cannot refer to these people as terrorists. I won't allow it. They're not terrorism. They're not being charged with terrorism. It has nothing to do with this case.
Yeah.
But what you don't see is that report in the media. What happened, the fact that that term, even though our representatives at the Trey Arrow Defense Committee were there that day, we heard it, we know it's there, it's been reported.
It's in
the transcript. It's only been reported once in an article by a corporate media outlet, and it was the last line of a very large article. You tell me why the corporate media outlets, which are continuously reporting the fact that eco-terrorist Trey Arrow that, eco-terrorist Trey Arrow this, are not reporting the fact that the judge in Trey Arrow and Jacob Sherman's case, and basically a judge of the land of the state, said terrorism has nothing to do with this. I won't allow you even to talk about it in my courtroom. I will not allow you to I don't want to hear the T word again because it has nothing to do with this case.
Yeah, the judge knows that in order for a person to have a fair trial, you can't have already... You can't basically do a smear campaign on them so that they will be punished heavily, or that the jury will be swayed, or that the court will be manipulated by hearing it. So I'm glad that judge sees it, but I'm sure the FBI hasn't really changed their tactics. The media.
The media, which...
I mean the FBI. No, I mean the media.
Both.
No, I mean the FBI.
They're
no,
both.
I mean corporate America. I
yeah.
mean, oh... No, they're all the same.
They're all the same thing. But what's important to recognize is where the media comes into this play, which is hence why our talk tomorrow is going to talk about the media. It's going to focus a lot on the media. And the media as a judge, and how the media has become literally the judge and jury in Trey's case. There's a man named Ron Arnold. Ron Arnold's the vice president of the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise. He is, by his own terms, a propaganda specialist. His job as the vice president of the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, his job as a member of the right-wing elite, is to spread the information that his funders, that his organization, the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, it definitely doesn't sound like an environmentally saving organization. It sounds like the most right-wing capitalist PR group you can ever think of, the Center for the Defense of...
We covered this on a previous radio show, right. This guy.
Yeah, like, the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise.
He created the term eco-terrorist.
Exactly. He's a man who, with his specialty... And with his multi-million dollar budget, which is provided by multinational logging companies and companies which support and benefit from the destruction of the environment, his organization has been pushing and developed and has been pushing the term eco-terrorist within the corporate media's headlines. You tell me why they are pushing that term. Why would they be pushing an ideology or a set that this, you know, long-haired, shoeless vegan hippie is an eco-terrorist? Was because that their funders are the main, you know, beneficiaries of the destruction of the environment. And by silencing an individual who is dissenting the destruction of the environment, who is protesting and rallying and organizing people to save the environment, is a tactic that they've been putting millions of dollars into with Ron Arnold and the Center for Friends of Free Enterprise, as well as another organization called the Stop Eco-Violence. These PR groups... Their sole purpose is to convince the media, the corporate media, and more importantly, society, that these environmentalists are radicals, are terrorists, are only out to destroy and be violent. The fact is that no action by the Earth Liberation Front, which is the number one domestic terrorist group in the United States, no action by any environmentalist have ever hurt a human being. But the fact is, the Forest Service has a long, long record of killing, directly killing. You look at David Chain, yeah, who was killed directly by a tree falling on him.
Yeah, I remember David.
You have loggers who are paid hundreds of dollars a day to fall a tree within a centimeter of where they wanted to fall it on. And why did that tree and that logger just happen to fall and on top of a man sitting on the ground? Protecting the forest. There was no investigation into David Chain's death. You don't have the logging companies be called eco-terrorists by the FBI and Ron Arnold and his specialist. You have the environmentalist. You have the idea that the media is a mode for convincing society that these individuals are guilty. So Ron Arnold and his group has gone forward propagating their right-wing agenda that these individuals are terrorists, to watch out for the environmental movement, to watch out for the Cascadia Forest Alliance, to watch out for Trey Arrow. He's an eco-terrorist. He's violent. He's dangerous. You can't trust him.
This Ron Arnold guy, I remember, University of Nebraska, he was brought in as an expert on eco-terrorism for their Department of Criminology. And it was like, so you can create a term and be an expert on it just by creating it. And so he was teaching people in law that eco-terrorism is a real thing, where it wasn't. It's just a contrived idea, a contrived thing for the corporate interest.
Very, very much. I mean, like, the questions are very central in this Torah is, one, the one-word answer is, what is the most important end result of any corporate media? Profit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't have corporate media donating their CEOs don't donate their annual, you know, income to, you know, nonprofit organizations or saving the environment. The second question is, what's the most effective term known to our world, to society right now, in selling headlines?
Yeah,
terrorism. I mean, communism in the McCarthy era was the number one. It's been taken over by terrorism. I mean, like, if anyone reads the word terrorism in a newspaper, they usually stop and find out what the terrorists are doing. You put Trey Arrow, you put eco-terrorists together, you convicted a man of a crime he's not even set foot in a courtroom for. The fact is that media outlets, not only just in the United States, but here in Canada...
I know. I'm so sorry.
...are refusing...
The
National Post, just not even using the word accused, suggested, alleged eco-terrorist. They are purely just stating, and I quote, eco-terrorist waged war from hospital. That's the National Post. Eco-terrorist ill after refusing most jail foods. That's the Vancouver Sun. The next one, eco-terrorist arrested. That's the Oregonian. These are papers who are not, I mean, one, they've been bought into Ron Arnold's propaganda that this man is an eco-terrorist or even an alleged eco-terrorist, but they're just refusing to use the word term alleged, suggested. It's like
almost like they're American owned.
Well, almost like they are. They just happen to be, which makes you feel like you're sitting in, you read your daily paper, and you know there's a murder trial happening in your city, and you see murderer John or Melissa X, first day of trial, and you're like, wait a minute. They're not even found guilty yet. Why are you calling them a murderer? It's like Trey's not even set foot in a courtroom and you've already convicted him of terrorism. Now you tell me how 12 jury members in Portland, if Trey is extradited back to the United States, how 12 jury members in Portland are going to go through 4 years of corporate media lies and information about Trey Arrow being an eco-terrorist this, an eco-terrorist that. How are they going to sit in a jury box and deliberate unbiasedly towards Trey's case? How are they going to be able to decide whether the information is correct? Is for the last 4 years they've been bombarded with eco-terrorist Trey Arrow's guilty of this crime.
Yeah, how is he going to get a fair trial?
He's purely not. That's why the Trey Arrow Defense Committee has been working so passionately and so hard to educate people and to make people understand that the media has literally become the judge in Trey's case. The fact is, most people right away, I mean, during our speaking tour, we've talked in almost every major city from Halifax to Vancouver, Vancouver Island. We're here in Nelson tomorrow night. And in one talk, we had an elder who had listened to our entire talk. An elder who had been an environmentalist for years. She came up to me after the talk and she thanked me. She appreciated what I brought forward. She understood what I brought forward. But she said, I just can't agree with his tactics. I just don't agree with burning logging vehicles. And I took a step back and learning from Trey and learning from other people, I approached the situation nicely. I was like, well, unfortunately, Trey didn't burn the vehicles. Like, you're mistaken. You went through the entire talk and you're still stuck on the notion that he's guilty. And I asked her, where did you hear about Trey first? And she says, well, I get the National Post every morning.
Oh.
And I was like, the National Post? That's great. Take a look at this flyer. And I showed her the flyer. And I was like, the National Post has said this in their headlines, that Trey Arrow is an eco-terrorist. You have been so manipulated by the corporate media subconsciously that you've convicted him of the crime. You are an elder in Fredericton, New Brunswick. That is, trust me, a 5-day bus ride, which I've done across Canada from Portland, Oregon.
Oh my God.
How do you think individuals in Portland, Oregon are going to be dealing with hearing the exact same titles from their local newspapers? Are they going to be biased when they go to the jury like this elder was? The fact is, you add in the fact that the media outlets are so interconnected to the environmental movement, to the environmental destruction, to destructive movement.
Resource extraction.
Well, I mean, where's the paper come from? It's got to come from somewhere. The fact is that one of the companies that Jacob Sherman targeted was a company called Ross Island Sand and Gravel. Ross Island is a sibling company, and its fellow sibling just happens to be a newspaper outlet called the Portland Tribune, which is the daily in Portland, which is also one of the most right-wing papers, and is also the paper that continuously, always puts eco-terrorist Trey Arrow. It is owned by the same man. It is owned by the same communications group. It is owned by the same company, which wants to get back at Jacob and, you know, the alleged connection with Trey as being, you know, guilty of those crimes. I mean, you have these papers who are extremely biased. I mean, look at Fox News and its reputation with extreme bias towards, you know, the string, you know, pro-Republican message. I mean, you see that connection between the logging companies and the environmental movement in the newspapers in the Portland area and all across the country. So the media has so much become a member, or so much become a tool of the state to convincing society that these environmentalists, these radicals, these anti-globalization members, these anarchists are so violent, and you must, you know, resist what they're saying. You must believe us that these people are violent eco-terrorists.
Yeah, the manipulation is complete. It's coming on. So let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the extradition process, where Trey is, and we'll talk to you some more. Here we go.
spend more time watching nature programs than experiencing the real thing. More time laughing at TV jokes than joking around yourself. More time watching TV sex than making love yourself. Then there's something you're missing. Television isn't real, but the addiction is. A message from the Media Foundation.
There was a major attack that led to the 50s, which were very quiescent, rather similar to the 1920s. This has been a recurrent pattern through American history, democratizing tendencies, repression, and quiescence, and then things blow up again. At that time, there was a lot of new technology that helped, and that has a lot of bearing on the present day. So in the 1920s and the 1930s, radio was coming into existence. Radio, everybody recognized, is a public resource. You know, it's not like shoes. There's a fixed band that's going to be government regulated. Everyone knew that. The question was, where will it go? Will radio be assigned to the public interest, meaning public radio, hence democratic to the extent that the society is democratic? You know, that's one option. The other option is just hand it over to private absolute power, and turned into a device for propaganda and profit-making by the private sector. Well, just about every country in the world, maybe everyone, I don't offhand know of exception, went the first way towards making a public resource. The United States went the second way, became a private monopoly, a virtual monopoly. I mean, like a college radio station could have a little station that you could hear for 3 blocks away or something. But this issue was struggled about. Labor groups, church groups, other public interest groups sought to put the United States within the mainstream of Western society, and they lost. They lost flat out. That's a reflection of a lot of other things, the extent to which we are indeed an unusual society with a highly class-conscious business community always fighting a vicious class war and very well aware of it. These quotes that I read from the National Association of Manufacturers are quite typical. That was radio. By the time television came along, it wasn't even an issue. The world went one way, the United States went the other way. That's coming along right today. We're right in the middle of it, with the question of this, you know, information highway business. Again, there's a question. Is it going to be a public interest resource serving a democratic, democratizing function, as the technology certainly allows, or is it simply going to become another instrument of corporate power and corporate propaganda and thought control and concocting artificial wants and so on and so forth? And the answer to that depends on the balance of forces. The way things now stand, you can predict it's just going to be another instrument of thought control and corporate power, but it doesn't have to be. You know, these are questions of how people react. More other countries, not very different from us, in fact, very much like us, went the other way with radio and television, and we could have too. It's a question of organizing and activism and awareness. One of the reasons for the intensive propaganda is to keep people from thinking about these things.
One, two, three, eight. This one is a warning. This one is a warning. This one is a warning. Well, if you listen to the warning, come now. This is a warning. The food they can't fit some on them and this with madness. Some of them like a terrorist. What a thing, you know, hear you blaze up the district. They see Larry Slane. They keep on us in a bed of pain. Come on, never give a damn. I'm against some of the profit. Otherwise, they might look reflective. The next trick, boy. How would they might lick them? Must be supersonic. Well, they got the badness. I come your seven a target. They had the warning. This one is a warning. This one is a warning. But if you listen to the warning, this one is a warning. But this one is a warning. This one is a warning. But this one is a warning. This is a warning. The total mentality check. They have the division captive. They have the whole your interest. I never claim to be the best, but nevertheless. Them can't test consciousness, I will left them speechless. Ooh, they were in a crisis, a sign of the time. Revelation and defensive, put on a seat, you must be blind. Political ideology, I forget left behind. They cut the check up, but you care what they bring. Hear the bell chimes, are they warning? But this one is a warning. This one is a warning. But if you listen to the warning, this one is a warning. This one is a warning. This one is a warning. But this one is a warning. Give me no sign.
Step up and take your best, best, right? Best shot, shot.
This one is a warning. This one is a warning. This one is a warning. But if you listen to the warning, come now. People get hostile, look at a man get savage. You give them a instant quick to come take advantage. But if you listen, then I think you got impartial knowledge. Millennium is a basis that we carry the message. It's a warning. But this one is a warning.
As soon as you come into this dive, I think you get held in this sort of amazing force-shielded temporal warp thing. 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 Thing.
Welcome back. This is Fane of the Cosmos. I'm speaking with Ben Shannon from the Trey Arrow National Speaking Tour, which will be at the David Thompson Student Society Center for Performing Arts. No, Charlotte's, tomorrow night at 7. We're talking live on CUNY Co-op Radio. This is Fane of the Cosmos. So, Ben, what... Now Canada's into the game. You know what I mean? Like... We always fancy ourselves from the oldest times that we can remember in history for being a country that protects people from oppressive regimes, including the United States. When it comes to prohibition, we always had alcohol up here. When it came to slavery, we always offered freedom to people up here. When it came to civil rights, we've always tried to be ahead of the game, and now we have Trey in our cradle. How did that happen? How he's in our hood? What's going down?
Well, he's similar to you know, the 125,000 plus draft dodgers. As you know, on top of all that, you have the Underground Railway. You have, you know, all the topics you mentioned, the draft dodgers. And you have a huge slew of people who have come to Canada seeking asylum. And Trey is just one of many.
Totally,
I'm sure one of over a million people have come up to this country for asylum of some nature. Trey's case currently is a tricky one. It's an interesting case. He's been incarcerated now for over a year in a pretrial center in Vancouver. The last year, he's been basically in an 8x8 cell awaiting his fate, whether to be shipped back, if you will, quite literally to the United States to face the onslaught of the FBI.
So the U.S. has initiated extradition proceedings against him?
Yeah, the Canadian government and the United States government do have an extradition treaty, which basically, in layman's terms, it basically comes down to if the United States can provide evidence, and that evidence doesn't have to be valid.
No.
It doesn't have to be real. As the case of Leonard Peltier became, if you're aware of, Leonard was extradited solely on an affidavit signed by a lady named Pooh Bear, who apparently was a girlfriend of Leonard at the time when Leonard was sentenced and convicted to shooting and killing two FBI agents. Yeah, Pooh Bear was the Pooh Bear's affidavit was the only way for Leonard to be extradited back to the United States from Canada. Though Pooh Bear, 2 years after Leonard's extradition, came out and said the FBI threatened to kill her if she didn't say it, and she never even knew Leonard, let alone was his girlfriend, let alone seen him shoot two agents. So the evidence against an individual in an extradition process doesn't have to be valid. It just has to be evidence, as you can see. So the extradition process, which the United States is appealing for, in layman terms, they just need to provide evidence, some evidence, and they have that evidence. They have the testimony of Jacob Sherman, the convicted arsonist who received 3.5 years instead of the 30 plus he would have received for his crimes.
Contrived facts.
Contrived the four days of FBI interrogation. So now, after Trey's been incarcerated now for a little over a year, he's basically facing an extradition hearing in June, mid-June. We're going to the extradition process and hoping that the judge at the time, the Supreme Court judge, will recognize the political nature. The only way the Canadian government can stop an extradition hearing, to refuse, even though there's enough evidence, to refuse an individual to be sent back to their country. We have extradition treaties with many countries. The United States is one of them. The only way they can refuse that is if they believe the individual's human rights will be violated. Now you tell me what good a judge, or how is a judge in this country going to state that they don't believe an individual's rights will be violated, or that they believe the individual's human rights will be violated to the democratic country, to our south? That would blow up. You would see softwood lumber. You'd see, beef. You'd see all that shit, all the political nature between the United States and Canada escalate when a suggested eco-terrorist by the FBI is refused extradition because the United States is going to violate his human rights. I mean, the United States would be up in arms about that.
Yeah.
Winning an extradition hearing against the United States is near to impossible.
I've been studying the case law, and it's virtually impossible.
So for the next in June, we go through that hearing, and let's say that we aren't lucky, and Trey is the extradition is approved. We can go through another 12 months of appeal processes throughout the Supreme Court of Appeal and throughout the Minister of Justice, which actually has to sign off on the extradition.
Yeah.
For the next 12 months, Trey could still be incarcerated in a pretrial center.
Now, what has his bail been set at?
Well, Trey's actually, the media not only has played a huge role in the part of society and our communities for understanding and thinking that Trey is guilty of this crime, of this arson charge, but they've actually been very effective in convincing the prosecution, but more importantly, Patrick Dome, who's the Supreme Court judge in Trey's case right now, that Trey is a violent terrorist, and you cannot let him out of jail. There has been individuals in front of Dome who've been released while awaiting an extradition back to the United States, not for arson, but for murder, and they've been released on minimal amount of bail money, $25,000 as an example. Trey's bail, because he is a violent eco-terrorist, quote the prosecution, and I was there when they said that in court on December 3rd of 2004. They said, Patrick Dome set a bail, Justice Dome set a bail of over $300,000 because Trey is an eco-terrorist in the prosecution's mind. That is how much the media has been affecting Trey's case.
Mm-hmm.
So now the Trejo Defense Committee is stuck with burden. It's like, how are we going to get this raw foodist out of prison? How are we going to get him out for the next 12 months of appeal processes and extradition hearings? He can be free with his friends and his family. I mean, he hasn't touched a loved one in over a year. I mean, the physical connection he gets has been when he's pushed around and beaten up by inmates in the pretrial center, or when the guards are moving him around. And they're definitely not very caring when they do that. So we're really trying to work on trying to find someone
with 300G,
a surety, property value. Not just to be cash up front; it has to be property. So we're working hard on that as well to dispel the myth of Trey as an eco-terrorist. So it's really that's what we're facing right now. And if Trey is extradited back to the United States, if the appeal processes go through and we don't win, and he actually crosses the border, the prosecution is charging Trey with 14 crimes, all arson related. Two end ones are two new charges. He had 12 earlier. Now he has 14. The two latter are the two interesting charges. The two latter basically come from the Oklahoma City bombings. They're not charges. He participated in the Oklahoma City bombings, but they're new charges, new legislation that came out of those charges, or out of those incidents. This one charge basically states if you intend to build and can inspire to blow up something, which Trey is accused of doing, you have a minimum sentence. There's no max. The maximum isn't in there. It's a minimum. The minimum sentence is 30 years in prison. If you conspire and build an incendiary device, a bomb, 30 years in prison. There's a little clause in that charge. That clause says if you were convicted of that crime twice. Trey is being charged with that crime twice for both the alleged firebombings that Jacob Sherman participated in.
Yeah.
Twice. The clause states if you were charged and convicted of that crime twice, there's no minimum. The minimum goes away. It's a full life. You carried out in a pine box sentence. If Trey's convicted of just those two crimes, not even the 12 prior arson charges, he will not come out of jail until he's dead. No chance of parole. And that's the kind of the kind of precedent they're trying to set with Trey's case. That's the kind of onslaught we're going up against, that Trey is a violent eco-terrorist and must spend the rest of his life in jail, when in fact he is the most compassionate individual I've ever met. And the reason why I've traveled all the way from Halifax to Nelson to Vancouver to the Vancouver Islands to bring awareness and attention to Trey's case, that this man will quite literally, by the time this trial's consist of a so-called fair trial, will give the rest of his life if he's convicted of these crimes.
Now, I didn't know any of this about him, but I met him and I knew him, and he was the most gentle, elfin, kind, smiled, twinkly-eyed guy. His vision in my mind is always with a smile and always with a twinkle in his eye. And I don't think there is a mean bone in his body. I don't think he could conceive of blowing something up. I don't think it's possible in his, consciousness to even conceive that, or to, he's just not one of those guys. And so
I mentioned earlier,
any one of us can be demonized like that. One of us could be turned into, if you were a vegetarian, you could be turned into a edible terrorist. Or if you were they can make any one of your decisions in life into some kind of terrorist thing. You could be a psychedelic terrorist. You could be a you know, an agricultural terrorist for planting kamut or spelt, or you could be a, you know, every time they get a new term tacked on to terrorism, that means a whole new group of people who are into civil disobedience, are into activism, are getting shafted. And you're next. Yeah, you, at home right now, eating that lentil soup. You're a vegetarian terrorist.
Well, what's so interesting is you're right about the case is that literally Trey was just... is any one of us. I mean, anyone who organizes passive, you know, peacefully, you know, non-violently, caring about the environment, caring about other people. I mean, that's not something that the government or the FBI or capitalism or society in general wants to promote. I mean, like, examples are just Jeffrey Freeler's case when he got 22.5 years for burning SUVs. I mean, like, we hold so much value over property. Trey is so polar to that. He cares about human life so much. He cares about the environment, and he cares about what's good in the world. That's actually opposing the state, and that's what they want to silence. I mean, political dissent has been crushed and destroyed by the FBI since its inception with the slacker raids and against the draft dodgers and war resistors in the early world wars. I mean,
trust me, we know. We've felt the brunt of American media manipulation. We tried to have a draft dodgers statue here in Nelson, and holy media manipulation galore.
Of course. So that's where Trey's case, you know, relies on. And we really need help from the community. I mean, the defense committee is working ecstatic, like immensely hard to one, raise awareness, but two, to actually help Trey to keep his spirits up. I mean, he's a man who has not touched, a man who lives in trees and lives for trees, hasn't touched a tree in well over a year, hasn't touched a piece of grass, hasn't touched an animal or another loving creature in a well over a year.
Okay, listeners, pay attention. This is where you come in handy. And if you have a heart and you understand what's going on here, this is where you can make a difference.
We really need people to check out our website, treyarrow.org. That's TREARROW.org. There's a many things we need help with. Everything is from the smallest to the largest. We need people writing Trey, telling Trey what they're up to, how they're doing, just communicating with Trey, giving Trey some stuff to read and make him feel connected with the community he cares so much about. Visiting Trey. If you're in the Vancouver area, you can visit Trey. Go and stop by and talk to him for an hour while at the pretrial center. Let him know. I mean, if you're in a cell 24 hours a day, an hour-long visit with somebody is the sunlight in your day.
Oh my God, it's so blessed. I've been in jail, trust me. Any visit, any correspondence, like, you know, you get bored of the books you're reading and you start to go nuts just knowing that it's like being in this radio studio. We don't know anybody out there is listening at all.
No one.
But when somebody says, "Hey, dude, I heard you on the radio last night," you're like, wow, it's real. Like, I'm not alone in the studio. And so it's the same for someone in jail. They don't know anybody's thinking about them. They don't know that we love, you know, we love him and that we're thinking about him. So it's got to be a physical manifestation of an internal situation, you know?
Totally.
Like, if you're loving, you got to write him or visit him or...
Yeah, so you can check out the website. You can get the actual the mailing address to mail him a letter, or you can find out information on how to visit him. Other things, you know, like as a defense committee, we of course need legal funds. I mean, we're dealing with 2 full months of trial in the United States against the FBI and the onslaught of their millions of dollars of investigation work. We have to, you know, break their information. We have to prove them to be liars. I mean, you know, Judy Berry and Daryl Turney's team, legal team, proved the FBI's lies many times and lied in their case when Judy Berry and Daryl were
blown up
in 1990. I mean, like, they have a documented record of savage violence against activists, and we have to crack that. It is not going to be cheap. We need money for legal defense.
Cash. We need cash.
We also very desperately and very honestly needs people to help step up and help us try to find someone who could possibly bail Trey out with property value. We only need we just need someone with property value worth $300,000 or more to put that forward as a surety. I mean, Trey doesn't have to live there. Trey never has to visit there. We just need somebody who has that money who's been there, who's come up from the United States as a draft dodger and been like, you know, that was me, like, you know, 30 years ago, and some dude took me in on his farm, and I worked on a farm, and now I've got my own farm, and now I'm willing to help somebody else out. We need that individual. There's a wide spectrum from writing letters to possibly bailing Trey out, and there's so much in the middle you can do to help. TreyArrow.org, TreyArrow.org. Check it out. It's a new website. You can also download links to audio interviews with Trey, mm-hmm. including a very new documentary we're going to have posted there in a few days. Done out of Winnipeg about Trey and his case. Really, really inspiring documentary.
That's on www.radio4all.net. That is the radio activist radio archives. This radio show is also featured on those archives, so it's a good place to be. And I just listened to the documentary tonight. It's stellar. It's a Canadian production. So if you have a radio or you know someone who you'd like to get the facts, but you can't lay it all out for them, you can give them the link to this website and you can download the program, and it covers it all.
On the website too, on TreyArrow.org, you have lots of information, flyers, who Trey Arrow is, extensive history, other articles, a link to what you were saying, the radio documentary. To check that out, you can find out more information about how to get in contact with the Trey Arrow Defense Committee and our folks here. Locally, here in Nelson, tomorrow night, David Thompson Cultural Center, 7 o'clock. You want to come out, you want to meet some members of the Defense Committee, you want to get some flyers, some information. Like, you know, Trey's got a music CD we're going to have on the table for sale. He wants to make some little donations to cover that, see some of his music he recorded before he went to prison or in the pretrial center. But I'm going to go in tomorrow night, I'm going to go into more about how the media's role in Trey's case has caused so much hardship in the defense committee, and how they've been quite literally the jury, hence or the judge, hence the media as a judge, the case of accused eco-terrorist Trey Arrow, and we're going to talk about more about that. So 7 o'clock in Nelson, Dave Thompson Cultural Center, tomorrow, Monday, the 18th of April.
Okay, so let's just take a chill second here. We'll turn off the music and just, gay listeners, give your little scalp a massage. Get your crown chakra beaming. This is your consciousness satellite. We're going to send out some prayers of love and goodness. And picture trees sprouting up in his cell, and the tinkling of creeks during the freshet, and birds singing. And just picture this elfin guy bathed in white light. And let's pray for this guy and get some, feed him some good chi that he's not getting in prison. Let's use the crown chakra beam, and let's use the heart, the green heart beam, and let's do some praying tonight. And, pray for Trey. Pray for Trey. And, we all could be there. We all could be in that cell right now, alone, tired, wondering what the hell is going to go on with our lives. And so he needs our light and our love. So tonight, when you're going to bed and you're chilling out, and just for a couple seconds, this isn't like, you know, I'm not trying to pull the hippy-dippy on you. I'm just saying it's when you're in jail, it's a whole other scene, and you need love and you need the chi goodness. So let's beam it out to him. Everybody tonight, if you're listening to this radio show right now, do some praying. Pray for all your loved ones and the people, but let's put Trey in the fray. And yeah, you could be next, you vegetarian terrorist. So let's stop it now before the media gets complete control. Ben, I'm so glad that you came. I'm so glad that you're here.
Thank you.
It's like, yeah, we all have one heart and one soul and one spirit, and it's good that we get to share this time together.
Thank you for having me.
Right on.
Wicked.
Woo! Okay, we're going to bust out.
There is an indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. I feel it, though I do not see it. It is this unseen power which makes itself felt. There is an indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. I feel it, though I do not see it. It is this unseen power which makes itself felt and yet defies all proof, because it is so unlike all that I perceive through my senses. It transcends the senses, but it is possible to reason out the and yet defies all proof, because it is so unlike all that I perceive through my senses. It transcends the senses, but it is possible to reason out the existence of God to a limited extent. Even in ordinary affairs, we know that people do not know who rules or why and how he rules, and yet the existence of God to a limited extent. Even in ordinary affairs, we know that people do not know who rules or why and how he rules, and yet they know that there is a power that certainly rules. That informing power or spirit is God, and since nothing else that I see merely through the senses can or know that there is a power that certainly rules. That informing power or spirit is God, and since nothing else that I see merely through the senses can or will persist, he alone is. And is this power benevolent or malevolent? I see it as purely benevolent, for I can see that in the midst of death, life will persist, he alone is. And is this power benevolent or malevolent? I see it as purely benevolent, for I can see that in the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists. Hence I gather that God is life, truth, light. He is love. He is the supreme good.